I went up to him and I said, how do you go from 10 million to 100 million? And remember, I'm asking this to a guy. I'm asking this to a guy who's worth $3.3 billion.
Right.
I said, how do you go from 10 million to 100 million? So he looked at me and he goes, Nitin, you're asking the wrong question.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Welcome to the show. We're so glad you've tuned in for Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is Darren Clark, the producer, and we hope you're staying healthy wherever you are and enjoying these conversations with high-level entrepreneurs. So today, we have Dr. Nitin Chhoda talking with Roland Frazier about his journey so far as an entrepreneur. He founded InTouch less than 5 years ago, a growing software company that serves as an engine for over 1,500 physical therapy practices. So I think you'll really appreciate his take on a relational versus transactional way of doing business. Also, working with teams overseas, and listen through to the end for some priceless advice that a multi-billionaire passed on to Nitin. Plus, if you're considering a software business or project, glean from Nitin's expertise as he shares his mistakes, advice, and insight with Roland. So let's get stuck in.
Hey, everybody. Roland Frazier here in Phoenix, Arizona for Business Lunch. Welcome to the show. And I have my guest and friend, Nitin Chhoda from InTouch EMR. Mm-hmm. We are bundled up in Phoenix, despite the fact that we're in Phoenix, because today I woke up and it was 35 degrees.
I wasn't expecting that.
Where the heck are we? So that's why we're bundled up and we're in Phoenix. But thanks for being on the show. I appreciate you.
My pleasure.
Today. Tell everybody a little bit about kind of where you are currently in your entrepreneurial journey, like kind of the company, what it's doing in terms of revenue and stuff like that. And then let's dive into the journey, how you got there.
Absolutely. So I'm the CEO of InTouch EMR, which is a software company for physical therapists and doctors. We help them with anything that has to do with running their practice. We have about 1,500 clients now doing anything from using our software to using us for business coaching. We do about $1.8 million a year gross. And we built all this up in 4 or 5 years from next to nothing.
That's pretty great. And Sal, what was your first entrepreneurial endeavor?
Copying another business. I mean, I think in the beginning, Roland, when I had no ingenuity, I was just modeling what people were doing in the fitness industry. Because as a physical therapist, there really was, when I started about 10 years ago, there wasn't much innovation. So I looked at other industries, specifically fitness, and looked at what guys were doing. And, you know, a lot of fitness trainers, chiropractors, are extremely innovative with what they do. And I saw a fitness trainer doing business coaching.
And you were a physical therapist at the time?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Actually, before I got my physical therapy license, I was a trainer. I worked as a fitness trainer.
Oh, okay.
Which is how I'm in business with my business partner, Jeff Sherman,
Okay. Who's
with me in the war room. So Jeff and I actually met 10 years ago, and I looked at fitness trainers, and there was a trainer doing business coaching, mastermind groups back 10 years ago when, you know, it wasn't really a trend.
Uh-huh.
And he had this email newsletter marketing software, and I was amazed by what he did. And I joined his mastermind and I went up.
It was his software. Oh, wow. Okay.
I joined his mastermind. I ponied up the money and I went up to him and said, listen, I love what you're doing. I want to copy what you're doing in the physical therapy space. Do I have your blessing? And he said, look, as long as you're in my mastermind and you're not competing with me, I don't care. And that's how it began.
Nice. So how much was that mastermind to join?
$10,000.
And was that a pretty big investment for you at the time?
It was. It was pretty significant, but it paid off in spades, just like the war room is paying off now.
Thank you. What caused you to make that investment?
I think intuitively I knew that I would stagnate if I didn't surround myself with people who are smarter than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan of watching and learning from other people. I think I absorb things like a sponge.
You do. You're amazing at that. And you actually take action on them, which is unusual.
That means a lot. Thank you. And so I wanted to observe and, you know, be the guy who's sort of low-key, just taking notes and executing.
Okay.
And so I figured the only way to do that was to join a mastermind group and look, be, you know, peel back the layers of the onion and feel like an insider. Because you have to pay to play.
And what did you get? Yeah, you do. And what did you get out of that? Like, did you know in advance that he had that software and you wanted to do it? Or was that something you kind of learned as you were part of that group?
I think when I joined the group, my goal was to model what the other person was doing and, you know, start making money.
Okay.
Because I wasn't making
a
whole lot.
In physical therapy, though?
As a physical therapy business coach.
Right. Okay.
Yes. Because that's when I started about 10 years ago. But I think over a period of time, it evolved into relationships that I'm doing all sorts of business dealings with. So it began, I would say, Roland, in a transactional way. Because back then, 10 years ago, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but
my identity was my business.
My identity was how much money I made. And I was very, I think I was insecure in myself and I was transactional. And I think as you grow in your business, you become less transactional, more relational. And I think that's part of evolution as a human being.
I agree. I have seen that in you. Is it 6 years now in War Room?
It's actually eight.
8 years?
Yeah.
God, time flies. Yeah. So, because I not in a critical way, but just in an observation, I've seen that you've become much more relational and less transactional. And when you first came in, it was kind of, but I think that has to do with where you are success-wise and how comfortable you are and that kind of stuff too. Because when you need money, you need money, right?
Your emotional bandwidth is used up in running your business and paying the bills. And you don't have the emotional bandwidth left to enjoy relationships and build relationships.
Yeah.
And I guess I hope we all go through that journey. I'm 42. I guess I went through that journey relatively late.
I don't know. Some people never make it. So, okay. So you joined and you were building your physical therapy practice or business. And when did you get into software? Because that's a pretty significant change.
Yeah, I think the key with software, what I've learned is finding the right developer. And that brings me back, I'll answer your question in 30 seconds, but this is important. The right developer is like a unicorn in software. For example, in sales and marketing, you could have person A and person B, and person B is probably, 30%, 40% better than person A.
Right.
But in software, if you get a good developer, a unicorn, and he's person A, person A in this case is going to be five times better than person B, not only because of the way they code, but because of the way they think.
Right.
Like if I go, let's do this feature. Like, are you sure you want this? Because if you do this, this happens. And although I don't know how to code, I've now started to think like a developer and think logically because developers have to think not two moves ahead, four moves ahead. And so how that ties into the answer to your question is I was born and raised in India. And so I can not only converse Hindi, which is my native tongue, but I can see through the BS with developers in India. And I was able to find developers that were unicorns. And so when the first software succeeded, which was an email newsletter marketing software, I said, you know what? I'm going to go head to head with the biggest players in the industry and build what's essentially a scheduling, documentation, and medical billing software, which is, it's a huge undertaking. And, sort of struggled along the way. You know the struggle. My biggest competitor tried to sue me and put me out of business. Mm-hmm. But the short answer to your question is the decision to get into software was for two reasons. One, I had access to, and I know how to identify unicorn developers, which is the key. That one unicorn is better than having five average developers.
So how did you know that? Because you weren't in software.
I think that I think I instinctively have a sense of people and specifically developers because, when you talk to a developer, you understand very quickly whether they're thinking three or four moves ahead.
Okay.
A good developer will say, why do you want to do this? Why don't we do it this way? And why don't we do it this way instead? Whereas an average developer will say, okay, you want this? I'll get it done in 6 hours.
Did you have somebody that had done software development that was kind of helping you or mentoring you or giving you advice or consultation?
I did have a project manager, but I think I learned as I went along. Don't get me wrong. I've gone through my share of really bad developers.
Sure.
But I think
the one that took all the code from those other people.
Who tried to, yeah. There was no source code. But that's an interesting story, which is not fun. But I think that going through my share of bad developers and finding a couple of unicorns made it pretty game-changing. Because, Roland, a good developer can build you the next WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Can build you anything. And whereas a bad developer will just rely on your vision. So development is a very interesting creative process. And so for me, if I could find a good developer, which I did, and obviously if I could get recurring revenue, because that was my foot in through the door, I could make a name in the market. And then what we've started doing now is started graduating to services.
Yeah.
So, for me, honestly, it doesn't matter whether a client pays me 50, 100, 200 bucks a month for my software. What matters is we get to do the service for them, which is, if you want, we can get into that. When I started the software, my end game was to start doing medical billing for doctors. So we become indispensable for them. We become a done-for-you service where we literally become sort of the foundation to their cash flow.
Okay.
So the software was an end game to the bigger picture, which is becoming an extension of their practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty long end game, but now that the software is stable, things are starting to pan out.
Okay. So for somebody that is thinking they might like to do a software kind of development project, what would you advise them 1, 2, 3 stepwise? They have no experience. They're just like you were back in the day.
Yeah, I think, you know, the good news with software is you don't need to know code. That's number one. Number two, you need to have an intuitive understanding of what your market wants, what the audience wants, and the best ideas are the simplest ideas. You know, WhatsApp, for example, was a software that integrated, you know, cell phone numbers into messaging. There was a LinkedIn tool, I believe, called Rapportive, R-A-P-P-O-R-T-I-V-E. Yep. I think it was built by, if I'm not mistaken, somebody in India, just one developer. And it was a Gmail plugin that sort of pulled in their LinkedIn profile when you emailed them back and forth by Gmail.
I remember that.
I believe he sold it to LinkedIn for $1 million within a year or two of having it. So my advice would be, it's okay if you don't know code, but you need to have a really good idea that adds value to whatever is existing out there. Please don't do Me Too products, because you'll waste a whole bunch of time, effort, and money. I'm going to save you guys, hopefully, tens of thousands of dollars. Don't do a Me Too product. Your product has to be significantly better or something that no one has thought of before. And if you can come up with that idea, the next step would be to obviously get a good developer and then go to market with it. Because at the end of the day, this is all about how many users you have and how fast you can scale.
Right.
So I think it comes down to the idea and then finding the unicorn. Because there's a flip side to this. You could have an excellent idea, but if you have someone who's not capable of executing that vision from a development standpoint, then you're in trouble. And I don't believe in the concept of project managers. A lot of companies, you know, give you a developer and a project manager. I think that the owner who drives the vision should work with the developer who executes and amplifies the vision.
Okay.
A project manager is like a third wheel who, you know, is needed when a company reaches a certain type of scale.
Okay.
But I think, you know, even though right now we have 6 developers and I have over 200 people executing the service, we don't have a project manager. Mm-hmm. They converse directly with my customer support team, and we try and keep it lean and we stay hungry and we keep improving the code, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So where would you look for a developer today?
You know, this is interesting. You know, US developers are excellent, although my developers are overseas in India. I found historically that in India, you get a lot of technically strong people who are very strong at coding. In the Philippines, you get a lot of people who are excellent at customer support and, you know, who can speak the English language, you know, without a thick accent. Mm-hmm. A lot of my staff in the Philippines, you know, they speak, you couldn't even tell.
Yeah.
So I would go to India for developers. I don't have much experience with other countries like Russia or Croatia and stuff like that.
Where would you look online, like if you were trying to find those people?
I would do Odesk.
Okay.
I think Odesk is good, and that's where I found some of my top developers. There are a lot of freelancing companies that will help you find developers. I used one a couple of years ago, but, you know, then their developer ended up contacting me after she left them.
Oh, okay.
So I think if I was a beginner, I'd begin on Odesk. And I think a good way to start with the developer role in it is if you have a simple project. For example, you say, you know, build me a script that allows me to, you know, to collect email addresses from LinkedIn profiles. This is just something I'm spitballing here. How fast can you build that script? And what is the best way to achieve the outcome? If you put out, and obviously I was spitballing, if you can have something that's specific to your niche, let's say you're a real estate person and you want a script that allows you to scan Google Places, I don't know, and pull up lists of local business owners, let's just say. And if you put out a request like that to Odesk and you say, look, you know, I'll pay $500 to somebody who can do this in 5 days. Then you start to identify the developers who can get the job done quickly and who are hungry, more like a pre-qualification thing.
Okay. And then the ones that respond and do a good job, then you kind of go for the real project.
Exactly.
That's great advice.
But finding a good developer is the key, because once you find a good developer, they can pretty much execute on anything.
Okay.
So that to me is king.
Is there like a language that you should be looking for or anything like that? Or does it just not really matter as long as they can do it?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask. There are a lot of different languages out there. So we use Java, which is sort of a more modern language that essentially is the foundation of a lot of enterprise solutions. So broadly speaking, you know, there's PHP, which is an outdated language, and there's Java. So I would say that when you're developing, my experience is Java applications tend to run faster and smoother, but you don't have to be married to a certain language. You can say, this is my vision, this is what I want the code to do. I need it to be web-based.
Okay.
I need it to eventually become mobile at some point, because that's the world we live in. And then let the developer lead the way. because there are other languages out there as well, and sort of let that be their problem. In general, though, it's interesting you ask, there are certain languages where it's harder to find developers.
Okay.
For a language like Java, it's harder to find a developer, but that's not a bad thing. That just means that, you know, as you grow, the barrier to entry is a little higher, which is a good thing. You don't want something, you know, you don't want to, I mean, a WordPress developer, is someone could rip you off in a couple of days.
Right.
And the barrier to entry is low. So in general, I think the language doesn't matter. But if you adopt a language that's less common, you're likely to succeed because there's a higher barrier of entry.
Okay. What would you say are some of the mistakes that you've made that you've learned the most from that you might share to help other people not make those mistakes?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I would say the number one mistake is trying to... Okay, let's back up. The number one mistake is not being innovative. Yeah, yeah. There's like 50. We don't have enough time for all of them, but the big ones. If you're building a product and you're trying to get better than a competitor, be innovative. Don't just be a Me Too player. Because if you're a Me Too player,
great advice.
You're going to attract the wrong kind of client. The client who's a client who's price sensitive, a client who is only comparing you, you know, with everyone else. They're not just looking at what you have to offer as unique. So I would say you've got to have a unique idea. I think initially my number one mistake was being a Me Too player and trying to be slightly better, not significantly better than my competitors.
Okay.
Number two mistake was I did hire a developer that was unscrupulous, that, you know, not only didn't do the deliverable, but then who just turned around and simply said, you know, I'm not going to do the deliverable and I'm going to hold you hostage for the code that I've already built, which was a pretty challenging experience. I would say the number three mistake was we did get involved in a lawsuit with one of our competitors who thought that we were copying them, which we weren't. And, you know, we simply said, thanks to, you know, an attorney you introduced me to, Roland, you know, the attorney said, look, let's compare source codes, because a source code essentially is sort of the underlying backbone of an application. Mm-hmm. If you were to hack into another company's system and copy their source code, you know, that's illegal. That's copyright infringement,
right.
which we hadn't done.
Right.
You know, and so when we were accused of copyright violation, which we hadn't done, we hadn't copied, we are obviously looking at all our competitors and trying to create a better product.
Right.
100% we were doing that. The interesting thing, and this leads to a mistake that we made, I actually hired a lawyer who was an absolute
okay.
For lack of a better word. He looked at me and he goes, oh my God, Nitin, you're going to have to pay $200,000 and da-da-da. It's a big lawsuit. Da-da-da. And I was like, I need a lawyer who's more aggressive,
right.
Who's smarter.
Right.
And you introduced me to Grant Teeple, who's, yeah. You know, who's Gene. So Grant picked up the phone, talked to opposing counsel and said, hey, let's compare source codes, which was how the whole thing came to a resolution because, you know, I didn't have access to anyone's source code, but obviously we're watching and learning.
Right.
And since then, we've built a far more innovative product and, you know, my competitors are copying me. So I would say that the big lesson is when you work with a lawyer, and you will, as you grow, you are going to work with lawyers. It sucks.
May you not, but yeah, you probably will.
You are going to work with lawyers. You must work with lawyers who are aggressive advocates for you. You cannot work with a lawyer who's quote unquote a nice guy.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a demeaning way. I mean that I believe our system in the United States, because I think this is being seen around the world, but I think in our system in the United States, it's obviously important whether you're right or wrong, whether you did the right thing or the wrong thing. That matters. But what matters more than right versus wrong is what the lawyer can convince the jury or the opposing counsel is right or wrong. In other words, you know, a good lawyer who's not aggressive could end up hurting you more than an average lawyer who's extremely aggressive and who, for lack of a better word, goes balls to the wall for your client. So get aggressive lawyers who see your way, as opposed to just lawyers who, you know, wait 3 weeks for opposing counsel and then send them a polite email. That's my belief. Maybe you disagree.
No, I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that services, now you're doing services, and I know that
right. We
see a lot that Tim Cook has really taken Apple to the next level by adding services. What are the services that you added and how did you come up with that?
It's interesting you mentioned Tim Cook, because one of the things he said in the past couple of months was, his words, and I paraphrase, is in the end, what Apple will be known for is its contribution to health. Now, you and I at this point in time don't know what that means.
Right.
We see the existing ecosystem, which is, you know, you get the iPhone, the iPad, the watch, you have the iOS, all the iOSs connect with each other. There's some services. Apple TV has been introduced and so on and so forth. But interestingly, they're moving more towards a services model,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they started breaking down.
It's driven most of their growth recently.
Correct. And they actually stopped, I believe they stopped reporting iPhone sales, and they've now started to break down services.
I think you're right.
And they, you know, at the time of this recording, Apple reported their results a week ago, and their services revenue expanded significantly. So, they are essentially a technology and a hardware company that has saturated one part of their hardware. I think when 5G comes, we'll see another burst.
Yeah.
But sorry, I want to get back to your answer. But Apple's ecosystem right now, as we see it, if we come back 5 years later and look at the ecosystem, we're going to see a whole different ecosystem. And I don't know what that's going to look like. I mean, I would imagine that would be an Apple Watch that monitors blood sugar levels in real time, blood cholesterol levels in real time. That would be game changing.
Deeper, for sure.
I don't own an Apple Watch, but I will when that happens because I want to monitor my
sugar. I have it. I just can't keep charging it. It's that one extra device. That's the other thing that has to be somehow fixed because it's just another thing to charge, even with the wireless thing and all that stuff.
True. But Roland, imagine, and he said a contribution to health. Imagine if you and I, we have an Apple Watch, we're eating dinner.
Yeah.
And you have, you love wine. I had the best wine I've ever had, thanks to Roland. And imagine we have like four glasses and you see your blood sugar level shoot up to whatever, 245.
Right.
You're like, oh, I need to slow down a bit. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's going to make us live longer.
Absolutely. I agree.
That's going to increase longevity. So coming back to the answer to your question, our model is, we call it an ecosystem of services. The software is just an entry point to our service.
And what does the software do, just so people know?
The software allows a physical therapist or a doctor to schedule patients, to document their patients' medical records, and then to fire off the claim to the insurance company via codes. And then once the insurance company gets that claim, they process it, they send money back to the doctor.
Okay, great.
So our software essentially is the engine that drives their practice.
Okay.
You know, an e-commerce business would need, I would imagine, Infusionsoft, Drip, whatever.
Yeah. So what services did you add to it?
So this is interesting. We actually started by offering medical billing services.
Okay.
Which is,
where you'll do the billing for the doctor.
Yeah. We'll review the claim. We'll send it out. We'll call the insurance company every week. We'll make sure you get paid. And there are 1,000 companies, doing that. But I think the two big things that we did was, one, we introduced a very specific process to our service. And our process is on our website if they want to check out the website.
Sure.
I can mention the URL if you want me to. It's intouchbilling.com. And I think the thing that really drives most of our sales is if you go to intouchbilling.com, forget everything that's on the site, click on the word process. So under process, we have three phases. We call it, the detective phase, where we analyze your cash flow. But the game-changing thing is what we call the policing phase, where once we submit the claim to the insurance company, we become like the police.
The insurance company will come back and deny it, and so that you go back and chase them down for it.
And we actually tell clients that we function like a police force for you. We actually tell our clients it's us against them, which is true.
It is actually true.
Because, the insurance companies...
They won't give my wife her headache medicine sometimes. It's like, it's amazing.
My God.
It's like,
don't,
and then
this,
she has to go and
started.
Fight. Yeah. Let's not start that because we can go
and
on.
And they're doing this, pardon my friend, this to us. And the CEOs are flying around in private jets and everything. And their cash flow is higher than ever. Lobbying in Washington, the whole nine yards.
So you added a service that was very logical because people could buy your thing and use it themselves.
Right.
But they were like, well, what if you just did it for us? Right.
Exactly.
Basically.
Now, But because we are in a competitive space where there are thousands of other companies doing this, any mom and pop business, any mom and pop can start a billing company. There are companies in India with 5,000 employees who do billing for hospitals here in the US.
Okay.
But I think what allowed us to set ourselves apart is our process. Our process is that we have a methodical process. We submit the claim day 7, we follow up. Day 14, we follow up. If we don't get the payment by day 21, we send a letter to the insurance company saying, if we don't get paid in 7 days, we're going to complain to the local OIG, Office of Inspector General. So we become ultra aggressive enforcers, if you will. And that gets our clients paid. And our clients are so happy. We've had clients come in and now suddenly they're seeing so much more money that we pay for ourselves. But the other major thing that we did, Roland, was I think it's important to listen to the market. I think most of us are guilty of doing something that's incrementally better as opposed to really listening to the market and giving them what they need. For example, we realized that one of the big pain points with our clients was when you, Roland, let's say go to a doctor and you give them your insurance card, the front desk, let's just call her Amy. So Amy takes your card and she's got to now call the insurance company and find out what your copay is, what your deductible is. And then based on that, you know, they bill you, they bill the insurance company. That takes them upwards of an hour. Now, what's interesting is our healthcare system is the most complex in the world. The United States is the only country in the world with thousands of payers. Most countries have a 1-2-3-payer system. So it takes them an hour and they're super frustrated. Guess what? We decided to make the calls for them. We rolled out a new service. We just called it eligibility verification. We bought the domain, eligibilityverification.com. Nice. It was available. I'm surprised it was available. And then I have my team in India picking up the phone and making the calls.
Okay.
And we charge our clients $8 a call with a 50 call a month monthly minimum.
Okay.
So any client who comes on board pays us $400.
Right.
They get 50 calls a month, whether they use them or not. If they go above, they pay the $8 overage per call. Right. And they love it. And we have clients doing that all day long.
Okay.
And so that's a high margin business, which is resource intensive, but my resources are overseas. You know, the insurance companies, they get a call from someone in India who is working through the night, who does the job. And as far as the client is concerned, they just put in the first last name in a Google spreadsheet, a HIPAA compliant Google spreadsheet. We give them the deliverables through the spreadsheet.
What percentage of the business now is service versus the software?
If you had asked me that question 4 years ago, the answer would be 20%. The answer today is 85%.
85% service.
Because that's amazing, how fast it's grown.
That's so cool. And you have adapted a Wicked Smart entry to that's really kind of changed the business, right? It's adding a whole lot of business to you. Would you mind sharing?
Absolutely. So this idea is Vinny Fisher's idea. I love Vinny, and we tried to make it a little better.
Vinny's, but you've really taken it to the next level, which is super cool. Vinny liked that too.
So what we are doing now is we go on Indeed.com. And we just started with Indeed. We haven't even gone to Monster and the other websites. We've been doing this for about a couple of months now. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is, let's say, so I live in New Jersey. So let's say we go to, I don't know, Morristown, New Jersey, and you search for medical biller. So what happens is Indeed now gives you a list of physical therapy practices and physicians looking for a medical biller. So what we do is...
Looking to hire someone in-house that does that.
Correct. Yeah. So what they're looking to do is... Their intention when they post the ad is we need a biller because there's something wrong with our billing processes to come in and help us streamline billing because it's a complex process. And, you know, you can take this idea and apply it to your business. So what we do is we identify a couple of hundred opportunities a day. We create an Excel sheet which has all the lists of, you know, the opportunities. We then research the client's, the prospect's website, find their emails. We use tools like Hunter.io. This way, we're not just...
Hunter.io. Yeah. And who's doing this? Is this off overseas?
This is also overseas staff. Okay. It helps to keep the costs down. So we have staff that's...
Is that usually India or the Philippines for you?
This one's India. They're you know, very good technically, and they're sort of... It's very good behind-the-scenes work, in my opinion.
Is there a place for non-Indian folk to find Indian people? Or is it kind of your personal connections over there because you have family and stuff?
No, I think Odesk.com is an excellent resource for sure. I think Odesk.com...
Even for doing non-Cody stuff, for doing this.
100%.
Okay.
And, you know, if you go to onlinejobs.ph, which is, you can find some excellent, you know, overseas workers in the Philippines. And, you know, honestly, I mean, you could even hire college kids to do this for you.
Get them to go and get the email.
Yeah. So they go, they click on an Indeed listing. They get the URL, which is the actual Indeed job posting link. Their job is just to gather the leads, not to do the posting. And then we have an Excel sheet where we have first name, last name, what they're looking for, Indeed URL, the website and the email addresses.
Okay.
And then we have another individual who simply applies to all those ads every day. So we're sort of applying. And when we apply, we, you know, we're pretty upfront. We say, look, you know, we're an outsourced medical billing company located in New Jersey. We're not going to send you somebody to work in your office. But here are three reasons why working with us is better than having someone who's locally working with you. You know, it'll be cheaper for you because it's W-2 versus 1099.
Right.
We're not even a 1099. We're a straight expense for them, you know. So there's no W-2 expenses involved. We say that we're faster, we're more efficient, and we're very transparent, and we give you weekly reports.
Okay.
Because we're very accountable. We're very data-driven.
Yeah.
We tell our clients, you don't have to believe us. Let the numbers do the story. Month to month, no contract.
Yeah. So then what happens?
Then we invite them to schedule a call.
Okay.
And we're finding for every, I would say for every 50 people we reach out to, we're getting two calls scheduled. And for every three or four calls scheduled, we're closing one client.
And that client is worth how much?
On the low end, net profit, $500 a month. On the high end, net profit, $5,000 a month.
Yeah. Brent, how much does it cost you to run that through when you...
the three resources.
So they do four calls turns into somebody basically, right?
The three resources in India gathering the leads are $500 a month each. Uh-huh. The resource who's sort of in the middle submitting the job ads is $500-$600 a month. The three closers who are sort of handling the incoming calls.
Are they in the States?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The three closers who are in, they get paid by commission.
Okay.
So commission we close. Only. Yeah. We close a client, they get paid. So I have two structures. One is they get paid for every call they take. Or another structure is they get paid a flat fee if the client closes.
Okay.
And nice. it's all commission driven.
That's pretty awesome.
So that's a structure that's been working well for us.
So on moving over to just kind of to close out with a little bit of the personal side, you've created a game over plan for your family for anything happens to you, kind of if everything passes.
Right.
And now you're diversifying out into real estate and some other things.
Correct.
We just kind of share a little bit about both of those things for people before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I have a 5-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter. My wife is, 42, just like me. And so I have this sort of this fear that if something were to happen to me, they should be taken care of. So besides having a life insurance policy, which we should all have, and it should be a significant amount, besides having a life insurance policy, I said, what happens, let's say, if I disappear off the face of the earth tomorrow? So I actually created a very simple Google Doc. And I call it Game, Set, Match.
Mm-hmm. Game, Set, Match. That was what it was. Yeah.
That's okay. The name of the Google Doc.
Right.
And the Google Doc says, okay, if something was to happen, the Google Doc starts by saying, if something were to happen to Nathan, it would suck. But these are the steps you have to take. That's the first statement.
If you're reading
Google
this,
Doc.
I'm not here and I hate that. Yeah.
Correct.
That's
so, the,
cool.
so the first point is here are all the logins of the Merrill Edge account and the Fidelity account, da da da. Log into the account and, initiate the beneficiary because they're beneficiaries. The second is, we're in the process of setting up trusts where the properties sit in the trust. I have finishing that process.
Yep.
I moved very fast with the property purchase. I moved so fast that I haven't had time to really set up the trust.
Right, right.
And the second is, this is how to gain access to all the assets in the trust. And these are the people that you need to call if you want to start liquidating. Number three is if something were to happen to me and if the business is not sold, because right now, I'm running the business, then we would probably have to gradually wind down the business, retain a couple of key employees to at least maintain things, because I don't think my wife would run all of that. She's more of a put it in an index fund and enjoy a dividend kind
so
of person.
So is getting a professional manager kind of the next big thing for that business? So it will be an asset that could continue to go on if you wanted to?
Absolutely. In fact, that's what I'm looking for.
Good.
That's a search we're starting right now. But so the document outlines, the steps she would need to take. It has access to all the usernames, passwords, what relationships to shut down, what relationships to maintain.
So smart. We had a friend of ours, Andy Jenkins, who died of cancer not long ago. Another friend, Brendan Stapper, was killed in a helicopter accident.
Both
of those guys were super young, not time for them to go. And so having that, because I watched both of their spouses just, have to deal with all that stuff and not know really what to do. And it's a lot on top of losing the person that's the love of your life, right? So I think it's so cool that you did that. And then on top of that, you have diversified out into different things. Now, is it mostly real estate?
Mostly real estate, some stock market stuff, but mostly real estate.
Will you say your, just briefly, because you rattled it off to me when we were in Mexico, your criteria for investing in a single family home? I loved the detail that you had with it.
Sure. So I've started buying a lot of single family homes, primarily because I like the cash flow. I like borrowing money at 4.25%, 4.5%. Because, at an inflation rate of 2% in a couple of years, it's like borrowing free money.
Yep.
I think when you borrow money at 4.5%, I think you're actually getting paid to borrow money.
Yep.
Because as you, 30 years from now, my mortgage payment's going to stay the same, but my rent's going to be 3 times as much or 4 times as much as what it is now with inflation.
Yep.
30 years. So the 5 criteria when I buy a single family home are, 1, the monthly rent has to be as close to 1% of the property value as possible. You buy a $140,000 home, you want to try and get $1,400 a month in rent, but even if you don't, I don't go below 0.8. So, for example, $1,100 as a ratio of $1,400, I think is about 0.78. So I would pass on that deal. I can do math in my head real quick. I love math. So number one, the criteria has to be 1% of the property value, but no lower than 0.8. The second is the property has to be rented by the time I purchase or just about to be rented. I mean, I would close on the 30th if the property was closing on the 1st. If the property was closing on the 15th, I'm going to push the closing back to the 15th.
Yeah, got it.
So I wanted to cash flow from the get-go. Number three, it has to appraise close to the property value. If I'm buying something for 140 and then it comes back and it appraises at 130, I'm not going to, you know, I'm willing to meet the seller somewhere in between, but I'm not going to buy something that doesn't appraise.
Over market, yeah.
Absolutely not. You know, I'm not that desperate for deals. There are a lot of deals out there. Number four, the property has to be recently renovated and or rehabbed. I want to buy something where, you know, the
builder... You won't have to cap exit again.
Correct.
Anytime soon.
You know, all the work's done from the inside. So, exactly. And number five, it has to be at least a B-minus property, preferably a B+. Meaning it needs to be in a good neighborhood, preferably close to schools within a 5-mile radius, because that overall increases the long-term rentability of the property. And with these five parameters, I'm winning from the get-go, even if the property doesn't appreciate.
Really cool. And getting about 15% combined annual rate of return.
Yeah, I actually did the math. It's exactly 14.39.
That's great.
And it's post-tax because of depreciation and mortgage interest deduction. So that's not bad. In fact, that's what the stock market has done on average in the past 3 years, 15, 16% a year.
Yeah.
And the stock market historically can't return 15%.
Yeah, it's about 8%, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah.
So what did I not ask you that you would like to have been asked or like to share with the people before we close?
I think that, you know, the old sort of adage, you're the sum of the people, that the five people that you hang out the most with. I think that anyone listening should make sure they surround themselves with the right people. And more importantly, even if you have to pay to surround yourself by them, you should do it, because that's sort of the biggest lesson. One of my extended family members through my wife's side is a billionaire. He's worth over $3 billion. So I went up to him. We were at a wedding and it was, you know, a family wedding. I went up to him and I said, how do you go from 10 million to 100 million? And remember, I'm asking this to a guy. This was actually in my talk. I'm asking this to a guy who's worth $3.3 billion.
Right.
Said, how do you go from 10 million to 100 million? So he looked at me and he goes, Nitin, you're asking the wrong question. And I said, really? I think it was his polite way of saying that it was a silly question.
Uh-huh.
So I said, what question should I be asking? He's like, you should be asking yourself three questions. The first question is, how can you impact the maximum number of people positively?
Mm-hmm.
He said, number two is, how can you imagine a better future? Because imagination is more important than anything else. He said, there are a lot of people that can, you know, do stuff, but you need to imagine and you need to respond to the market. And he said, and, you know, the third thing he said, which I'll never forget, he said that you have to create unlimited wealth and abundance for your employees. And then I really thought about that. Now, that does sound like stuff you would read on a bumper sticker, but it was very profound for me because it made me realize that I shouldn't look at money as a number or a game or, hey, what can I learn from my network? I should look at how much value I can create.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that does come back to the kind of network that you have because, you know, I would like to think we're friends, we have a relationship. So that kind of approach, I think, is super important because if I can add value to you, then you know, at some point you'll add value to me because you'll want to.
Yeah.
Not because you have to.
Right, of course.
You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
But I think that was very profound to me, what he said. And he made me realize that I need to do game-changing things and then the money will automatically follow.
Yeah.
And obviously, the right network is a part of it. But that I would leave everyone with sort of these three core points, which is impact the maximum number of people, imagine better future, better services. And that could be software.
Yeah.
Right? Like we talked about. And create a lasting legacy for your employees. Nice. You do that, then your family will benefit. Your network will benefit. And, you know, I think that's a good place to end that.
That's fantastic. Cool. Well, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Fraser. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.
What if 3 days could change the course of your business in 2023? Get Scalable Live is where you'll gain great clarity on the next steps that will help you create the business, life, and wealth you deserve. Connect with business owners and entrepreneurs just like you, hungry for advice, proven strategies, and necessary connections to grow a business.
Literally, million-dollar conversations are happening in the hallways, in the bathrooms, across tables.
Get Scalable Live at Fairmont Austin, November 2nd through 4th. Tickets are on sale now at GetScalableLive.com.